Well, it's been a great pleasure to take part a little in the life of the community and to speak with people during tea times and so forth. As I reflect on practice, we are offered in Dhamma so many modes, so many approaches, so many ways of undertaking our practice and conceiving of a life of in Dhamma. And you know, for myself, I find working with sets of Dhammas, lists, you might say, sometimes just, you know, for a few weeks. Sometimes some of them I return to again and again for many years. And sometimes these are just observations from Kruba Ajahns that for some reason strike the heart and don't leave it. And so I can return to these observations with some benefit for long periods of time. I remember as a Samanera hearing quotation from Mahaprabhu Damo, who said, "Humility is the love of reality." And he didn't remember who that quotation came from, but something about it was particularly intriguing to me, and so I brought it up in my... It came to mind every day for several years. Things like that. So we have lists of Dhammas, the factors of awakening, and Mumpur Samedo, of course, we know, has worked with the Four Noble Truths as a central practice all his life, it seems. Lately, I encountered a list which I have found interesting and keep returning to with some benefit. And these are the Punya Kriya Vatu, the basis for meritorious action. And as I understand it, the list itself is a list of 10, doesn't appear as such in the suttas. All of the terms do, of course. But nevertheless, it became constellated at some time in the tradition. And it's a very interesting set of terms. Not all of them do we encounter with seeming regularity in suttas. Some of them are very common, however. But I think one of the benefits I find to contemplating these is that they are to some degree unfamiliar, and therefore they offer, they just enrich the palate, you might say, practice of contemplation. And one of the criteria for me for contemplation is that it is the use of thought, the movement of thought and ideas, but it tends towards silence. So it isn't the mind simply working and working and reworking and confabulating and becoming more and more complex. Rather, there is something in the midst of this process which inclines towards silence. So these 10 are, the first three actually are commonly found as a set, dana, sila, bhavana. So generosity, virtue, and cultivation, meditative cultivation. We were talking earlier about dana, its nature. There's a kind of movement of energy that's free-flowing when it works especially well. A kind of ease to it, opening the heart, giving freely, no expectation of reward. And yet we can't always act in this way, and so sometimes we recognize in ourselves a little selfish tendency, a hope for some kind of recognition. But that's okay, it's natural. Sila, the cultivation of virtue. Well, this is of inestimable value in our practice because it forms a basis for a foundation for the holy life, for any life in practice. 5 precepts, 8 precepts, 10 precepts, the whole of the Patimokkha, making of ourselves honest and harmless beings who intend well, who engage with one another properly, respectfully. And bhavana, of course, this is where our hearts and minds become increasingly refined, so that the quality of our attention becomes more and more clear. There is a kind of honesty and clarity to it. And this enables us over time with practice to begin to see things as they are, at least more clearly. And in doing so, the nature of our virtue becomes clearer, and all of life actually becomes transformed for the better. So those are the first three. The next is reverence. Apachitti, I think, is the term, reverence. Very interesting. You might recall having read in the, I think, Sunyutta Nikaya, reference to the Buddha. It's not so much referred to, perhaps, but shortly after his awakening, the Buddha reflects, and he's still in the vicinity of the Bodhi tree, and he reflects on the fact that one dwells in suffering who does not have respect for something, who is lacking reverence. So he asks himself, you know, who among the ascetics and Brahmins may I have reverence, should I have reverence towards? And he thinks immediately of his two former teachers of meditation and perceives that they have both passed away. And then he reflects, well, since they're beyond his ability to, they cannot receive his respect and reverence, realizes that he can give himself to, with respect and reverence, to a proper relation toward the Dhamma. So may I simply reflect with reverence upon this Dhamma which I have become awakened to. It's quite lovely to think of the Buddha reflecting in this kind of way and realizing that the heart needs some focus for of respect, where the beauty of life flows in a direction in this way. So we think in our own practice, reverence, what can we have reverence towards? Well, we have our teachers, we have living teachers, we have teachers in books that we have read of and respect because of their accomplishment and their the way their particular articulation of Dhamma has affected us, perhaps. There is even just a reverence for life, a respect for appreciation for life. Reverence is very closely akin to appreciation, isn't it? And gratitude. All of which take us outside of or free us from, unburden us of the that selfish kind of concern for needing more, lacking, needing more, having, wishing to have more. Next one is of these 10 is service. So this is a type of generosity, doing things which are useful, providing useful services, stepping in where something is needed. Service can take many forms. See it in a monastery, in a community where things are getting done every day, things are being cleaned, people are being driven somewhere. Forms of dhamma, dana rather, are evident in our service. And in say senior monastics, their leaders in the sangha, we see, it seems, when we reflect on some of these great beings, just whatever they do, it's clear that it is with the intent of serving their students, serving the sangha in some kind of way, of being proper examples that others might with benefit follow. This too is a great service, something to emulate and something to revere, in fact. And in ourselves, with ourselves in various modest ways, just stepping in to help, sometimes through words, sometimes through silence and listening, using the skills that we have to bring value to some situation. So the next one is an interesting one, I find. The sharing of merit. the generation of merit for others, the sharing of merit. I mean, we, in monasteries, of course, almost every day we are chanting, say, at the mealtime, to extend merit to those in need, people who have passed on, people who are sick, perhaps. But it's a very, this too is a very generous gesture and motion of the heart towards others. And it's a natural well-practiced and an ancient tradition, say, in Buddhist cultures, in Asian cultures. It may not be the first thing that comes to mind in a Westerner, using that term in a general sense, but to those who, first of all, encounter Buddhism through an interest in meditation, for instance. But extending merit to others and wishing that the merit that we develop in our practice, in our lives of Dhamma, that this generates energy which can be sent, you might say, in a direction, may bring benefit to others. The Buddha said that merit is another word for happiness. So what is it, whatever it is that brings us happiness, a sense of contentment, of accomplishment, of benefit in our practice, we have the ability to extend it to others. And this too is obviously an act of generosity, of opening of the heart, of the free flowing of the heart. Another of these 10 qualities is the rejoicing in the merit of others. So we think of mudita, for instance, one of the Brahmaviharas, rejoicing in the merit of others. Sometimes it's a matter of looking for what others have. Sometimes it may not be immediately apparent, and then we realize that some person is particularly patient in what for others might be rather difficult circumstances. They seem to have a kind of quality of patience, or perhaps there's a form of generosity seems to come quite naturally to them in circumstances that maybe seem less easy for us to generate generosity. Anyway, we find things in others, if we look for them, which are in their own way beautiful. And this brings a sense of joy. This can bring a sense of joy to the heart. All of these things unburden us of the burden of self, of the worries, a sense of lack, not having enough, not being enough, doing something, you know, the sort of critical, the inner tyrant that so bedevils us so often. All of these qualities unburden us of that sense, free up the heart and mind. The next two relate to Dhamma. One is teaching Dhamma. So this is a basis of meritorious action. There are conditions here, time and place, for instance. But freely giving and speaking Dhamma in appropriate, respectful ways is, as we all know, of great benefit to us. It's wonderful form of right speech. The other is listening to Dhamma. So opening the heart, listening as a matter of vital concern, as it's sometimes said. Opening oneself to the truth which is present in Dhamma. Doesn't always mean remembering everything that's said, but when Dhamma is being spoken, so often there is something in a discourse which strikes us particularly as being pertinent, perhaps, to our situation in the moment. And it's through hearing Dhamma, reflecting on Dhamma regularly, that our own capacity for wisdom develops, and the clarity of our own reflection develops accordingly. And the last of these is straightening of the view, straightening one's view. It's quite interesting to think of these 10. What comes to mind right now is the Buddha's brief instruction to Bahiya, who asks for some brief instruction so that he can go live in a solitary manner and practice with great diligence. And so the Buddha tells him, well, purify the beginning of all wholesome states. that is relates to the perfection of virtue and straightening of the view. And once that's done, when virtue is well purified and the view is straight, then give oneself to the practice of the Satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness. It's such a sweeping teaching. There's a such kind of completion to it, because it relates to all of our conduct, body, speech, and mind, and to the character of our thought, of our reflection, of our understanding, and ultimately of the development of wisdom. So as I say, these 10 bases for meritorious action, they, you know, there are some lists where it's quite clear that they're very, very much sequential, say. This is not, to me at least, that type of list. It just, each of these bears a kind of reflection, and at different times for me when I reflect on them, different of them come to, they sort of acquire a kind of prominence that speaks to me, and so I, you know, give them more time. I've been particularly interested, though, in this nature of reverence and of straightening the view, straightening one's view. I remember when I first came to Abhaya Giri, something that I had read and reflected on in the months previous to coming here, in which I shared with Lumpur Pasanna, was remarkable for me, almost unique little episode that occurs in the Samyutta Nikaya early on in the Vangisa Samyutta. And Kondanya, the firstborn, you might say, of the Buddha, who first became a Sotapanna after the Dhammacakka Sutta was pronounced. He, of course, developed full awakening. And then at some point, I suppose, possibly quite early on, left, and apparently was in the Himalaya for quite some time. So in this particular sutta, this short sutta, he returns to the Buddha after 12 years, hasn't seen the Buddha for 12 years. And it's very simple, but it's almost unique in my reading of suttas. He approaches the Buddha, bows down to him, and he strokes the Buddha's feet, and he kisses the Buddha's feet, and he says, "It's Kundanya, Lord, it's Kundanya, Blessed One." And I can't think of a more a briefer, but more a tender and powerful, impactful episode in the suttas than that. This great monk returning to his teacher and paying reverence to the Buddha. Sometimes monks would do so if they had an inclination that that their life was about to end, and I do not know whether this is the case in this particular instance. But the depth of that episode for me has been something that, for some reason, I have returned to rather often in the last number of years. So that's a matter of the heart, obviously. It's sometimes when I reflected on that, I mean, I kind of tear up. And on the other hand, the other side of things, you might say, is the straightening of view. And this I find of equal beauty in its own way. But to think of reflecting on Dhamma, reflecting on our lives, reflecting on the days of our lives, our experience, and framing this experience, framing these reflections within the light of Dhamma as we understand them, and perceiving over time the gradual refinement of these reflections and of this understanding. And I suppose this is the practice that we're all engaged in, this kind of straightening, this refinement, this maturation of understanding. And in that maturation, our lives become better, become clearer. We become better companions, better friends. And I do believe bring in our own ways, our own modest ways, an increasing radiance to the world. So I offer these reflections.